Good morning and welcome to this October 9th, 2013 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I will give you more information later in the hour on how to access our podcasts. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone, and as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each and every week, Barbara DeMarco Barrett is here with authors, poets, agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. I'm joined this morning by Rebecca Lee, author of the short story collection Bobcat, and coming up in the second half hour, Andre Debuse, the third, will be here to discuss his latest collection, Dirty Love. Rebecca Lee is a professor of creative writing at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington and the author of The City is a Rising Tide. Her stories have been published in The Atlantic Monthly and Zoetrope, and she was the winner of the National Magazine Award for Fiction for Fialta, which appears in Bobcat, the collection that is the subject of our chat this morning. Her fiction has also been read on NPR's Selected Shorts. The book, again, is Bobcat and Other Stories. It's published by Algonquin. It's my pleasure to welcome her on the show this morning. Rebecca, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Your collection is getting a lot of buzz around here. So I was just at a book event last night, and there were a whole group of women talking about it. So congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
I'm going to give you a chance to talk about it, kind of how the book came to be, how the stories came to be, how you thought of them as a structure in the collection, and talk a little bit about the book.
Sure. So I think there's seven stories in the book, and I wrote them actually over about the last 20 years. And the first one I wrote when I was straight out of grad school. So even now when I look at it, I have the same feelings that you might have for your younger self, you know, affection and worry all at the same time. And so in the collection, I usually write from sort of female narrators. There's one male narrator in here. But in some ways, the book follows her, you know, through her life. Even though she's a bit of a shapeshifter, she takes on other qualities in various stories. But she passes from a student to eventually a professor, and also from a child to a mother herself. And then the most recent story is a story is the title story, Bobcat. And that one really took me the longest to write. I've been working on it about the last 6 years. So that sounds sort of painstaking, but it was actually pretty pleasurable to write because it was all one night and one meal. And I got really interested in food writing and got to read all these great books that think about cooking, even though I didn't cook at all during that time. I just wrote about it.
Interesting. Now, when you were writing them, did the stories sort of track where you were in your life, where you wrote kind of the younger self when you were a younger self, and then you kind of evolved, or was it different than that?
Yes, it was. I mean, there's a little bit of a stagger, right? So, like, I'm always, like, 5 years younger or the narrator's always five. I shouldn't say I, because I guess it's not me officially, but the narrator's always about 5 years younger than I am. And I think that just has to do with how much time it takes to process experience and think about it and sort of change it. Although it's not an autobiographical book, but maybe by experience I just mean the experience of passing through that particular stage.
Yeah, right. And I do think it helps to have some distance from, you know, Even the act of writing the story is an event of your life, and you sort of need distance, I would think, from that to assess it properly, right?
Definitely. And just to even, you know, have any perspective on it, like have anything interesting to say about it, it takes me a really long time anyway to process things.
Yeah, right. Talk a little bit about why short stories, because short stories, I always feel like they get a short shrift, and I'm such a huge fan of them. Tell me about your feelings about short fiction, kind of what it does that the novel can't do and why you're drawn to it.
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. I mean, I tell my students all the time to think about, you know, whatever you're working on, what is the thing it can do that other art forms can't do? Because in some ways, your job is to capitalize on that. So, you know, even if you're writing a poem, or sometimes I talk about all of literature that way, you know, like what can people do on the page that you couldn't do, for instance, in a movie, because it's so obvious to us what a movie can do that writing can't do. So, like, what can writing really do? And I think, like, the short story in particular is, I mean, it's such an interesting little piece of machinery. I like to work in it somewhat it has to do with my limitations as a writer, that I like to think about sentences and paragraphs and scenes, but that's pretty much as far as my thinking goes in terms of a trajectory. And it's harder to think of an entire narrative, so a short story is a little bit easier for me to keep in mind. But I also write really slowly, so in some ways I feel like maybe if I were a different writer, I would be writing a novel, but with that same material. But I don't know, the words just come out slowly, which doesn't mean it's torturous. It's actually pretty pleasant, but it's just slow.
Yeah, no, it's kind of nice with this character narrator being kind of, I love this phrase of the shapeshifter, but you can do kind of both, right? You can examine this person in different plot points in time without having to have all the connective tissue of a novel, but you get the pleasure of seeing her over a period of time.
I think that's right. It takes a little bit of the pressure off the writer to have to, you know, make all the different parts think about each other so carefully.
Right. My guest this morning is Rebecca Lee. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The book is Bobcat and Other Stories we're talking about this morning. I read a blog entry that you did that had so many great observations about writing. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to torture you with some of the things that you've already said.
Okay.
That I wanted you to expand upon. And one was this observation about kind of the job of writing and how in one way you have this relationship between the writer and the reader. You know, you're kind of co-creators and you're co-conspirators in this project. And on the other hand, this observation that the chief importance of the work is to make the writer a better, more curious person, and therefore whatever the work is left over, you know, the book is sort of irrelevant. And I thought those two things in opposition to each other, but that still kind of complement each other, were really interesting ideas. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I love the way you put it, actually, better than how I did. but I teach writing, too, and so I spend a lot of time talking to students about their motives in writing a piece. I mean, I don't try to talk to them about that, but that just comes up for writers. And it is this sort of interesting mix of, like, this deep need to communicate, to actually have a relationship. And I do think that, like, the intimacy between a reader and a writer is profound. And, you know, I'm usually the reader in most of my life. And in some ways, those writers who have written things that meant something to me, they're these, you know, major figures in my life, and not just in my regular life, but in my mental life. So I really, that relationship is really important to me. And so the writer, like, I would feel heartbroken if I had felt I had failed the reader. And of course, you that comes to your attention many times after you've published a book by many people. But on the other hand, when you're sitting there at a computer, I mean, I like to hear writers think about this out loud, because it's almost like you're blind at that time. Like, it is also this, like, sort of deep encounter with just sort of what you're thinking. And there's a sense in which any reader or any outside source has completely disappeared in that moment. And I think that's important, too, you know, some sort of need to say what you've been meaning to say. Or maybe, like, I'm working on a story now that's, like, about some sad parts of my life, and, like, it's just really important for me to get the words in the right order to sort of capture what that sadness is. And it's there is a moment before the reader reads it when it's important just to me. And I never quite know how to, you know, distinguish between those two stages in the work. You know, when you should stop thinking about what you want to say and start thinking about what the reader needs from you.
Yeah, it's interesting. What I hear you saying is that in the early stages of the process, it's just you and you trying to mine what you have to say. And then, you know, maybe even after the book is released into the world, then you start having the relationship with the reader and start thinking about, you know, that kind of lovely dance that goes on with the reader in the aftermath. And maybe that's mm-hmm. maybe that's the right time to start thinking about the reader when it's too late, right?
Yeah, when it's too late. Yeah.
And you also had all of these really lovely quotes. One I've repeated to myself like 8 times this morning already, which is that it hurts to go through walls, but it's necessary.
Uh-huh.
And what a great quote for writers. I think every writer should put that up on their computer screen and just, it hurts to go through walls, but that's just what you have to do.
Yeah, no, I have repeated that line. I don't even know who was the poet that originally wrote that, and I've asked many poets who it was, but that is a line that has run through my head in the last 25 years since I read it, and it comes into my mind at the strangest times too. Like if I have to do an errand I don't want to do, I think of that. Like there are just some walls you have to go through, and then definitely when you're writing, like. I think for young writers, there's this sense that it should be effortless. And then the more you write, the more you realize that, like, every single day, it might be effortless for a few seconds, although that's pretty rare for me. But mostly it's just figuring things out in a more kind of workmanlike way.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Rebecca Lee. The book is Bobcat. When you look across kind of the work you've done across this collection and other stories you've written, can you kind of see the area of concerns for you as writer and separate as writer, but as, human and woman, and how they've changed over time?
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting, like, as I said before, like when you're actually sitting there writing, it's a little bit of for me, it feels like I'm in a wind tunnel or something. I don't really even know what I'm doing. But stepping back, it's possible to see a real set of concerns emerge in the work. And I can really see, too, and this was kind of a pleasure to see, honestly, it was a kind of maturing in the work. Like in some of my early stories, I can feel in the voice a real desire to please, not the reader exactly, that's actually kind of a good quality, but a desire to say the right thing versus saying the true thing.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And so I do see an evolution in the book of that. Like I'm starting to touch the hem of the type of writer I'd like to be in that way.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I guess that's just a process of maturity, both as maturity as a writer, but also maturity just as, a person, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Really interesting. I also wanted to talk about this notion of writing stories that are in the collection 20 years ago, and this sort of hits on that of how you. I look back at things I wrote, even 6 months ago, and sort of cringe.
Yeah.
And the revision process of taking a story that maybe was written 20 years ago, and do you just sort of let that story be what it was at that period of time, or does your 20 plus, those 20 years, do you go back and tinker with it and say, nah, I'm going to bring it up to the speed of the writer I am now?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I didn't do that with this collection, and some of it was just practical. I was working really hard to finish up the newer stories in time for a publication. But I also think, like, it was hard for me to actually figure out what to do with those old stories because it was locked inside the voice and the tone. And so it wasn't just like, oh, I could write a better image here, or this scene could be smarter or tighter. It was sort of a way of seeing things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just felt like I had to just let it go and let it stand. And for a while I had to, I hope my editor doesn't listen to this because she'll kill me, but for a while I would have to cross out certain stories when I gave it to people to read, like don't read this one. But then I started hearing back from readers and I realized that kind of, with that cringing that you talk about, that didn't seem to follow. I wasn't able to predict what stories would matter to readers.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Some readers, those early stories were much more interesting to them, and the later ones, they didn't say they weren't as interesting, but they seemed to be more invested in the early ones. So I kind of, at a certain point, I guess you just have to let a work go and do its own thing in the reader's mind.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and this observation about Bobcat taking 6 years to write, and interestingly, being a fairly discrete story taking place over the course of one night, over the course of one dinner, and yet, kind of expanding in your mind over, 6 years of time. How did that story start versus where it ended?
Let's see. That story started, I had just published a novel. And so I think I was looking for something to write that was pretty self-contained and pretty manageable. You know, there's this sense that, you'd like, or for me, I lose control of a novel entirely when I'm writing it. Mm. So I did, I was very attracted, and I needed that feeling of stepping back to the same scene again and again every morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a little baby then, too, so I didn't have, my mind wasn't like, sort of like roving over these huge territories at the time. I was really just sitting in the same apartment day after day. So maybe that was part of it, too. And it's interesting, though, because I kept, you know, in that story, there's a narrator who has a dinner party, and she has all these people over, and she's really interested in all of their lives. And that was sort of what it felt like when I was writing it. I was trying to look for the storyline in all these other people. And I don't usually do this, but I desperately needed an ending. It was being published by a press called Madras Press as a chapbook, and the editor there needed it, like, in a week's time or something. This was after 6 years of writing on it. And then I finally sat down one day, and I was like, I'm going to meditate. I'm just going to sit here and let the ending come to me. And I don't suggest this to any writer ever, but it happened to work in this case. And the ending, sort of the event that the whole story had been leading up to was in the narrator's life rather than in the lives around her. So it just struck me as interesting that, like, she was so interested in everyone else's life and, I mean, a gossip, basically, about what was going on with everyone else and not noticing sort of, like, the deep workings of her own life.
Mm.
So I think that's sort of where that story came from. I mean, in a way, it was a revelation to me what I was writing about all those years, too.
Right, right. Yeah, it struck me as just very true. I mean, I just think that's how people operate, right? Is if there's this, you know, if your house is on fire, it's better just to look at the neighbor's house and say,
and I'm like that, too.
Yeah, no, I think everybody's like that.
Yeah.
And let's talk about titles, because I think titles are hard, especially in short stories, because they have to do several things at once, and you just have to come up with eight of them instead of one of them for a novel. And I thought these were very varied and specific and interesting. Can you talk a little bit about titling stories?
Yeah, I had a professor once who said, just try to make the title not too embarrassing. And I always remember that. Like, you don't have to do too much with it. Just, like, make it not get in the way of the story, essentially. I'm looking at the title pages now. It's funny, I didn't really think about this till you asked this question, but they're almost all one word. Mm-hmm. So you can see that I'm sort of backing away from writing a long, ornate title, maybe just out of fear. So I think I maybe just look for a place or an element in the story and try to make that stand for the story. I don't have a method. I know sometimes writers look through their stories, like they write it and then they look for phrases throughout.
Right.
One thing I like to do is, and this has obviously never worked except for in maybe one, is I like the names of geographical formations or rivers. Like, those seem very inspirational to me. So if there's a place in the story, I usually find myself looking around there for the title, maybe.
Hmm. I like that. Yeah, that's good. That's good. I'm going to use that.
Okay, good.
My guest this morning is Rebecca Lee. The book is Bobcat and Other Stories. Do you get a sense? I know you're a Canadian writer. Yes,
I am.
Do you get a sense of a distance, geographic distance between Canadian and U.S. writers? Do you notice any differences between us or similarities between us?
People have told me this, and I don't know if who this offends more, Canadians or Americans, but. There is a longer tradition in Canadian literature, this is a generalization, of narrator observers who sort of stand back and watch the action and who are essentially thinkers on the story, almost a third person first, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, I don't know if that's a stereotype trying to think of, say, an Alice Munro story. That might very well be true of Alice Munro stories, that there is a kind of a watchful quality to them, whereas sort of in an American tradition, it's much more sort of the narrator becomes a part of the story themselves and becomes an actor and maybe even like makes the main action happen in the story.
That's really interesting. Yeah, now that I'm thinking about it, that's true. That's true. I always wonder if geography or weather have some, you know, Canada's just, I don't know too much about Canada, but it just strikes me as cold.
So
I'm wondering
cold.
If it's very interior and, you know, kind of, you know, you kind of have to huddle down and block away from the elements and all of that, which would make you an observer, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And also there's just, I mean, honestly, when I moved to Minnesota first, which also probably sounds pretty cold to you in California, but at the time it was really tropical and beautiful. You know, it wouldn't be snowing in April, for instance. But I remember having the feeling when I was at college that on the nice days, I didn't really like them because I felt like I should be out playing Frisbee or something. And then when it got cold, I felt justified in sitting in my room and writing. So there might be something about the weather pushing people indoors that helps writers.
Yeah, right. You were told by one professor he found this one true word in your work, which was the word liar.
Uh-huh.
And you called it this sort of invisible letter of recommendation that you carried around in your pocket with you. And then you revised one of these stories, you know, 100 times around that word. And, you know, the word is so evocative, obviously, and the concept behind it is so evocative. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, are there other words like that that you think kind of press you into action?
Yeah, it's interesting. There, we were talking earlier about the stories the early stories in here, and one of the tics I had as a young writer was to, I just had this deep desire to see the world as beautiful, so I kept describing like the moon as a jewel and like other things as jewels, and I don't know, there was sort of an obsession with certain words, which I now I see through my younger self. And maybe like I probably obsess over certain words now, and I don't even know what they are because I don't have enough distance on them.
Velvet. You like velvet?
I think it's, yeah.
That appeared a lot, yeah. Very.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because I was talking to Barbara DeMarco Barrett last night about the book, and she was saying, yeah, Rebecca really loves these certain words. And so now to hear you say that, that's. I mean, I think we all do, right? We all fall in love with certain words that we can't leave alone. And
yes.
You just need a good editor to go back and look at all of them. But
I know, to tell you that you've gone one too far.
Right. We're drawing down on our time. Do you have a really short reading? I'd love to hear your voice in the work.
Sure. I can read just that first paragraph, if that's okay.
That's great.
This is from the title story. It was the terrain that got to me. I felt queasy enough that I had to sit in the living room and narrate to my husband what was the brutal list of tasks that would result in a terrain. Devein, declaw, decimate the sea and other animals, eventually emulsifying them into a paste, which could then be riven with whole vegetables. It was like describing to somebody how to paint a Manet, how to turn the beauty of the earth into a blurry, intoxicating swirl, like something seen through the eyes of the dying. Since we were such disorganized hosts, we were doing a recipe from Food and Wine called the Quick Start Terrine. A terrine rightfully should be made over the course of 2 or 3 days, heated, cooled, flagellated, changed over time in the flames of the ever-turning world, but our guests were due to arrive within the hour.
That's great. That's Rebecca Lee reading from her title story, Bobcat, out of the collection of the same name. Any last words of advice, wisdom for writers?
Oh, just always, like, keep writing. Like, that's the thing that we all have to keep telling each other, that if it feels difficult, that's the right feeling, not the wrong one.
Do you write? You write every day?
I write every day, every morning.
Yeah. That's time of day, really. I don't know.
I
love that state of, like, the dream world versus the real world and, you know. And if you write something crazy, it doesn't really count because you can just say you're still dreaming or something. I don't know.
I agree. I totally think, for me, that's the bridge time, too. And even if it's just 10 minutes, you don't get any real work done, but it's a placeholder for, like, that's the time when writing gets done.
Yeah. Are you going to stick with short stories, or are you going to go back to novel?
You know, I'm working on something now that I think it is a short story. I sort of start with a narrative and then let it grow to whatever length it wants to, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think this one is a short story.
Yeah. I always wonder if writers are essentially short story writers or essentially novelists, or if you can do both equally well.
Yeah. I mean, I can sometimes read a short story by a writer, and their hand feels like a novelist's hand, like just the way they write sentences and the way they think.
Right, right, right. Do you read poetry?
I love poetry. I mean, it's sort of the free zone of writing for me, because I don't write it myself, so I can just read it with sort of a deeper pleasure even than I do the other genres.
Yeah, and you get that really love, the poets love their individual words and their...
Oh, yeah, and I mean, I read somewhere someone said, I mean, I'm sure many people have said that they keep the language alive for the rest of us, and I feel that.
Yeah, me too. Rebecca Lee, this was a huge pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you.
That was Rebecca Lee. The book is Bobcat and Other Stories. It is out and available now. You can find her her collection and look her up online. She's got a lot of great interviews, a lot of blog entries and things to read more about her thoughts on writing. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Andrea DeBus is going to be here for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We will be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. We gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're listening to KUCI Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at KUCI.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Antiquer Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes. We're under College Radio. Or you can visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. We have another great speaker series event coming up in a few short weeks. On Tuesday, October 22nd, Danny Shapiro, the best-selling author of the memoirs Devotion and Slow Motion and five novels, including Black and White and Family History, will be here talking about her latest work, Still Writing, what attracts her to the project, organizing material, structure, all that great stuff and more. I understand there are a couple of seats left, but they always sell out. So I would look up the details and ticket information on Barbara's website, penonfire.com. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I'm joined now by Andre DeBoost III. Andre is the author of six books, The Cage Keeper and Other Stories, Bluesman, and the New York Times bestsellers House of Sand and Fog, The Garden of Last Days, and his memoir, Townie, a number four New York Times bestseller and a New York Times editor's choice. It was named on many top nonfiction books of 2011 lists, including the New York Times, Publishers Weekly, the Library Journal. I really could go on. His work has been included in the Best American Essays of 1994, the Best Spiritual Writing of 1999. His novel, House of Sand and Fog, of course, was a finalist for the National Book Award, a number one New York Times bestseller, and was, of course, made into an Academy Award-nominated film starring Ben Kingsley and Jennifer Connelly. Andre has been awarded the Guggenheim, the National Magazine Award for Fiction, the Pushcart. He's a 2012 recipient of the American Academy for Arts and Letters. This goes on and on, so I'll just stop. He's a fantastic writer. His new book, Dirty Love, is the subject of our chat this morning. It is my pleasure to welcome him. Andre, hi.
Hi, Marie. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. This is a great collection. It's a great
Thank
collection.
You.
I love seeing you back in the short story or novella form. I'm going to let you introduce it because nobody does that better than you, and kind of talk about the inspiration for the stories, how they came together as a collection, and all of that.
Well, it's very strange, but it's not strange. You know, for me, and a lot of writers I've met over the years, so much of what actually gets into print are sort of the phoenixes that have risen from the ashes of what's failed miserably. For years I've been wanting to write from a certain kind of predator, not a sexual predator or a violent predator, but one of these weird guys you sometimes read about in the paper. And I tried to work my way into this guy about 15 years ago or 14 years ago, and, you know, I went back in time to his history, and what came was a, you know, philandering, carousing bartender who pretended to be a poet or lying to himself and cheating on his woman. And I didn't even want to write about this guy. I thought this was the father of my protagonist. But, you know, when I got into his point of view, he felt so much more alive and real than the guy I wanted to write about. And that's what happened with the second novella, Marla. This is going to be the predator's first victim. And she became much more alive than the guy I wanted to write about again. And, you know, it's sort of reflects my larger experience all the time here that, you know, just because you the writer want to write something doesn't mean it wants to be written by you. And I think there's a really important distinction that I found myself saying to writing classes quite a lot, that there's a difference between making something up on the one hand and imagining it on the other. So, you know, these novels seem to come from someplace deeper inside me than the novellas, than even what I wanted to write about. And the last two, the title one, Dirty Love, which is the longest, and Listen Carefully as Our Options Have Changed, came in the last couple of years after I had written Townie. And they seem to reflect some of my larger fears and demons and wants, which is, you know, this whole notion of trying to love well and be loved by others and how hard that is to do.
Yeah. Has that been your experience of the past, is having, you know, sort of a character in your head that you wanted to write about that never got written about, who was the impetus for other characters getting written about?
Yeah, exactly. And I like that you said in the head, because really that character, who I still find his story interesting, that character is still in my head, but it's not like, I don't think he's in my body. He's not in my heart, my chest, wherever these, you know, my abdomen, wherever these fictional dreams come from. I've said this before, but I feel as if when I'm writing well, that I'm writing more from my gut than my head. And you know, there's that great line from Gustave Flaubert who said that the writer is the last to choose his subject. The subject chooses the writer. And, you know, I've thought about that quote a lot over the years, and I keep finding it to be true for me. And then I've been thinking more about it. Well, yeah, but what's behind that? I think what's behind that is when that subject's choosing you, I think what's really going on is you're allowing yourself to admit that you're actually more curious about this than that. So it actually goes to your curiosity. What are you really curious about? What are you really drawn to exploring? And then when I think the writer finds that, and finds, you know, that authentic direction, you know, you're really something's happening now, which is artistically good, I think.
Do you think that's true of plot and character, that both the subject matter and the people are, you don't choose either of those, and kind of who the people are, you don't choose either of those?
No, yeah, there's a certain amount of contrivance, I think, sometimes that begins. You're like some Greek god, the writer is, who'll throw a character into a situation and then explore it. But I've thrown characters into situations that I thought I wanted to explore, but then a more interesting situation would show up, and then I would be forced to jettison what I wanted to write about and again explore that situation. But to go more directly to your question, I think, yeah, it's far more character than subject matter, that if you have the sliver of a human being that's starting to come to you, and the sliver of a dramatic situation, and by dramatic situation, all I mean is a scenario with some trouble in it. You put those two together, and something's going to happen, and it'll lead you to places that are, you know, that later people will speak about in thematic terms, but I don't think most writers I know don't ever think theme before they begin to write. They just find it.
Yeah, right. This might be a question about revision, but I'm wondering, I mean, at some point you kind of have to corral the story and the characters in.
Yeah.
And at what point in the process is it safe to do that? Is it kind of, you know, drafts into it where, you know, the characters have kind of worked some things out, and then you figure out what the story is really about and revise around that? Where in the process do you start taking control and take back some control from the characters?
I really like the way you just put that, where you describe the revision process as working with what you found, because it's still allowing the story to... You're still in the service of the deeper truths you found in the story. Whether they're truths or experiences you want to write about or not, you're still working with what you found. But you're right, there has to be a moment where the writer's less of this, you know, gushing fountain free-falling into your psyche, and there's a lot of moving around. You know, the writer Janet Burroway has a wonderful distinction between story and plot. She said story is a causal sequence of events with a beginning, a middle, and an end. But plot, which she encourages writers to look at as more of a verb than a noun, plot is how we arrange that causal sequence of events. And so what is the motivation for arranging them? Well, sometimes it's as simple as, you know, these 40 pages have no dramatic tension, I need to shave it down to two. Or, I needed to find all this out, but the reader doesn't need to be dragged through it. Or, you know, I've got six scenes that do the same thing as this one scene, so I'm going to shave it down to one scene. But all of those decisions, this rearranging of the material you found, I really think they have to come later as opposed to earlier. I think one of the dangers, for example, of being in a creative writing program or group is that we prematurely evaluate the audience. We think about them too soon. And you really must give yourself a chance not to think about the reader for a while, so that you, the writer, have a chance to find out what the story is, who the people in it are. And so you've got to write that causal sequence with the beginning, middle, and end. And then you're absolutely right. You're taking control when you start to rearrange and do the plotting. But even then, I would argue, the control is still in the service of what you found. At least I found for me that it works better if I'm still not trying to make any damn points.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean?
Right, right. Can you give an example of where you may have gotten stuck in one of these and how you found your way out of it?
Oh, boy. Yeah. So in the story of the bartender, which is the bartender story who aspires to be a poet but has a lot of self-deceit he has to deal with, and I think probably alcoholism, is I went back in time. I I discovered he grew up on a dairy farm in New Hampshire. You know, I don't know anything about dairy farms, even though I'm from New England. I don't even drink milk. And so I had to do all this research, and I wrote, I do not exaggerate, I think I wrote about 140 pages of dairy farm life over 6 or 7 months. And I actually thought, wow, I've got a novel. I've got a dairy farm novel on my hands. So then as I'm reading it through, as I'm in the revision phase, I realize I am skimming those pages. I'm finding them a little dull. And I'm trying to lie to myself and say, oh, but the reader's not going to find it dull. I just know this material so well. The reader won't find this dull. And then I remember this line from Elmore Leonard, which was beautiful. May he rest in peace. Elmore Leonard said, you know, try to leave out the parts that the reader skips. And I knew that I needed to write 4 seasons of Dairy Farm life through this kid's adolescence. But then I shaved those 140 pages down to 1.5 pages. And I knew by doing that, by the way, that it was not going to be the novel my publisher was hoping for, but it looked like it was going to be maybe a 50 or 60 page long story that maybe a quarterly might publish. And, you know, don't think for a second that writers at the professional level who are publishing their work don't have these subconsciously buried fears and concerns that keep them, I think, from making the hard decision to cut, you know, 7 months of work in 130 pages. But, yeah. So that kind of thing happens all the time.
Do you think so? Did you do any of that work? Like, let's say you wrote 150 pages on a dairy farm 25 years ago, and then does that stuff ever pop up later on? You know,
yeah.
Where you're like, oh, hey, here's the dairy farm again 20 years later.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It's weird. Yeah, and it sure does. And not even just from having written it, but from having witnessed something. You know, the character in Marla, I'm kind of fond of, you know, and that one, as you know, it's a woman in her mid-20s who, you know, these people aren't as rare as we think, who's fallen through the cracks and has never had a sexual life yet. She's been totally neglected or ignored by men, and it's not just because she's heavy. She has other things. She doesn't know what it is. And anyway, so she came from my psyche. I was visiting my sister in Miami 30 years ago, and I was walking across this very baking hot parking lot in Miami in the summertime, and I see a woman in the drive-through area. It's like this little ball turret gunner module, air-conditioned little bulb she's in, and I glanced at her for maybe 1 second. I just took her in physically, looked at her, wondered how weird that must be to be in that booth, and I just kept walking. And 20 years later, she shows up under my pencil as a main character, which I just find really interesting about the dream world.
Every person you've ever encountered is now shuddering that, oh, God.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah, but we're sadly, as you know, it's the one you reveal the most is yourself.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Andre Debuse, the book, Dirty Love. So tell me a little bit about kind of writing stories at the right time. And you were talking a little bit earlier about writing what scares you the most.
Yeah.
And as you look over kind of the arc of your own work, where you were at certain times of your life when you were writing that work, the things that were scaring you at that time, I assume the stories come out of experience, you know. Do you feel like your fears have changed over the years, and do you feel like your areas of concern have changed over the years, or do you think there's an essential nugget in there that remains the same?
Well, I think there's an essential nugget, and I think they've changed a lot. And the essential nugget is still very mysterious to me, although I think part of my essential nugget is I seem to be haunted by how wrongly things can go in a human life without being pessimistic or dreary about it. Truth is, I'm a very optimistic, upbeat, life-loving, people-loving guy, but I'm really haunted by how much suffering can befall us, and I find that endlessly interesting, you know, on a dramatic level. But yeah, man, as I've gotten into my middle years, hopefully middle years, you know, 50s, all sorts of different preoccupations have come my way. Mainly, you know, I've got kids, and there's a fatherly part of me that is much stronger than it ever was. And, you know, my wife and I are aging beside each other slowly over 25 years together. And, you know, this brings about preoccupations I'm not even conscious of, and I prefer not to be conscious of. But there's a wonderful line from Willa Cather, you may know, that it's kind of next to useless as writing advice because it's only helpful after the fact, I think. But it's a beautiful insight. She says that a writer is at her best only when writing within the character and range of her deepest sympathies. Isn't that beautiful?
Mm.
And I think that's, you know, it's the next useless as advice. Because you can't read it and say, okay, my deepest sympathies. Well, I think homelessness is mean. I mean, that's not going to help you. It's really only after you've written something that I think the writer can start to feel whether he or she was really writing within sort of the wheelhouse of their deepest concerns or fears or joys or doubts or, well, sympathies. But to answer your question about me, when I look back, you know, a very weird thing happened. So I write this accidental memoir, Townie. You know, I had no intention of writing it. It came out of an essay I was writing. And I end up writing directly about, you know, the violence of my youth and my single mother and all that stuff, growing up in the 70s in a mill town and how it shaped me. And a very strange, interesting thing has happened. By writing directly about the violence of my past, as me as a character instead of a character, I've noticed it in all of these novellas, which is the next thing really since Townie, is there's no physical violence. And I thought, wow, maybe by writing directly about it, I'm kind of free to write about something else now. I don't know.
Yeah, right. Or if it exercises some demons you have or something.
Yeah, I think it does something.
Yeah. We were talking in the first half hour, apropos a bit of that, about kind of the relationship between reader and writer and, you know, what the job of the writer is in thinking about the reader versus, you know, whether the somebody had this quote about the essence of which is, in the end, you know, the work doesn't matter, the book doesn't matter, but the process of change that the writer himself has gone through is really what matters. And
I disagree.
Maybe both are true. I don't know.
Yeah,
maybe both are wrong.
To me, the reader's sacred. Screw the writer. I'm sorry. I just think the writer's always last in this. You know, I think the first concern, the first and foremost always is the character, the characters and the stories in this dream world. It's the writer's job to enter into. And then the next most important person is the reader. And I think I'm kind of merciless on the writer. I think our job is just to show up and work our asses off and get out like good party hosts. You know, I saw, I did a talk with Alan Gerganis last night, and he said a beautiful thing. He said, you know, I think writers need to be good hosts for their readers. Mm. I love that.
Mm.
And it got me thinking, well, what is a good host? Well, I mean, maybe you can't take the metaphor too far, but you're always thinking about the reader in the final revision. In the beginning drafts, I'm not thinking about the reader. I'm trying to find the characters, and, you know, I'll let myself write 140 pages. I know I'll cut to one, which, by the way, by cutting it to one is where I become a good host to the reader. But your larger point about the relationship, I think it's, you know, I'm not a religious man, but I sure believe in the sacred and the divine, and I think that there is a sacred relationship between not the reader and the writer, but the reader and the book, the reader and the character.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I just think the job of the writer is to bring the reader into that and then back the hell off. There's a wonderful line from Leo Tolstoy who defines art quite simply and elegantly, I think. Art is transferring feeling from one heart to another. And I just love that. Well, how do you do that? There's only one thing and one thing forevermore, forever and ever, that's going to transfer a feeling, that's going to make anyone feel anything. And that's the truth. That's our job. Our job is to illuminate truths, not big grand ones like war and peace, love and death, capitalism, democracy. But all of those can be illuminated, of course. But if you can just capture what it's really like to be a woman waking up hungover in a hotel again, whatever, you might begin to capture something about feminism. I don't know. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, right. Yeah, and you've had all of these visceral jobs. I feel like you've never had an interview that hasn't covered this, so I apologize. But you've
That's
had
okay.
all these really great visceral jobs, a bartender, an office keeper, and halfway house counselor, all these great things. And I'm wondering, did you intentionally sort of get yourself down into the grit of life with the woman waking up halfway hungover in a hotel room again? You know, a lot of these jobs seem like, you know, the bounty hunter. I know you didn't do it for too long, but it seems like you're going to witness, I don't know if it's more truths of human nature, but the grit of human nature through all of these jobs and how much you draw from that.
Yeah, I mean, but I think I think you're right about the grit part, but it was never the motivation. For me, it was, you know, I prefer to write in the morning, and all of those, you know, marginal kind of jobs happened at night, and that's why, you know, I found myself sitting in a car in February in Colorado watching a hitman's girlfriend watch TV and taking notes for the FBI. I mean, how the hell did I get that job? I don't know, but I liked it because I could write in the morning, you know, and the truth is, like a lot of people out there, I grew up marginally, you know. I went to 12 or so schools before I got out of high school. I've never felt part of the in crowd. I got used to that really early on, and the truth is, I find that I sympathize or empathize or identify more with people who are in the corners. And you know, too, you know, Marie, I think most of us are. You know, my life has gotten so weird in the last 10 years where I've met some very powerful people. You know, it's funny. You scribble in a notebook, publish some books, and you find yourself talking to people you never would have met, you know, yeah. In big, shiny halls and whatnot. And I'm really glad I've gotten exposed to the upper classes now, because I see just as many people in corners there as I do in, you know, waitresses waking up hungover in a hotel room. I have this belief, and I try not to insert any beliefs into my fiction, but I do think that a lot of us are walking around feeling as if we snuck in the back door and we're fooling everybody. We really don't know what the hell we're doing. We're just doing the best we can. You know, I have a hunch that most of us feel we're kind of, you know, in the corner. Even bank presidents and CEOs and, you know, people you think are right in the shiny center of things, you go inside them and scratch the surface and you may find out otherwise.
Maybe especially those guys of late, right?
Yeah, maybe especially, huh?
Yeah. This, apropos of nothing we've talked about before, but I wanted to hit on this before we left. You once said that writing on a computer is sort of like a spiritual condom. And I love that just because... I love it for a lot of reasons.
Did I say that out loud?
And then I quoted it back to you. Even worse. But I do think there's something in the medium of a computer that gets lost in the... aside from the you know, allure of checking Wikipedia and Google every 5 minutes. But there is something between the relationship between the writer and the computer that... I don't know. It doesn't seem quite as... visceral, or it seems, you know.
You know what it is for me, and of course, there's no right or wrong way to do any of this. Some of my favorite writers write on computers, of course, but you know, I wrote this morning with my Blackwing 602 pencil and in my meat composition notebook, and the reason I do it this way. Well, I think of that Flannery O'Connor line. I think it's from her essay, "The Nature and Aim of Fiction." She said, "You know, the job a writer's job is not to write about character, but with character." And, you know, I interpret that line to mean, yeah, we've got to get inside them. We've got to become them. You know, in the same way that wonderful acting is not pretending to have the emotion, wonderful acting is having it and having the courage to show it. Hmm. And I think that's the writer's job. So for me, I can't compose on the keyboard. It does feel like a condom separating me from the, you know, the heart of the experience, and it's got to be, so for me, you know, I've got the pencil in my hand, it's, you know, flesh, blood, bone, wood, paper, maybe a trick of the mind I use to get me inside people instead of outside them.
Yeah, no, I love that.
Thank you.
We've drawn down on our time. Any last-minute words of writing advice?
Well, you know, what do I know is my first thought, but I will say this, and I'm going to quote a writer better than I'll ever be, Richard Bausch. He's got a wonderful line. He says, "If you think that you are thinking when you're writing, think again. You're much closer to the dreaming side of your mind. So dream, dream, dream it through." Mm-hmm. And I completely agree. Of course, then there's the revision process where you do a lot of thinking, but you're still cooperating with the truth of what you found. You know, I do think that the writing is larger than the writer, and that's what I would say.
I love ending on that note, the writing is larger than the writer. That's great. That's great.
Thank you.
Andre DeBuse, this was a huge, huge pleasure. Thank you so much.
For me, too. Thanks so much for calling.
Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
That was Andre DeBuse. The book, Dirty Love, is out and available now, and another fabulous piece of work by a great writer. You can find him online. That's all the time we have for today. Barbara DeMarco Barrett will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So again, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.